Okay, here we are. We're in the shooting distance of the end of the second perek, at the bottom of Kaf Hei Amud Aleph. You recall the Mishnah from the top of the Amud, this famous story about Rabbi Gamliel's Kiddush HaChodesh, which was questioned by other Chachamim. And his treatment of Rabbi Yehoshua. Rabbi Yehoshua was certain that the Chodesh was declared on the wrong day. And this, of course, put forth a potentially dangerous rift in the Jewish community. So Rabbi Gamliel is gozer that he has to come on the Yom Kippur that falls out according to his own calculation.
With his makel,
etc. You know the story. Oh wait, before we move on, did you have anything to add from last week's astronomical conversation?
Yeah, I did. I forgot, I might have written you something, but you're recording from this very interesting sheet from, I forget where, Web Yeshiva, not Web Yeshiva. Right, but it was explaining there, right, when Rabbi Gamliel says sometimes the moon travels a short way and a long way. And the question is, how does that help? Because either way, if he says he saw the moon in the morning and the evening, it still wouldn't be enough. And so over here, he claims that the Rambam says that there are times when you could see them within six, that when the moon takes, quote-unquote, a short way, you could see it within 6 hours, which means if you saw it in the morning and 12 hours later in the evening, it'd be possible.
Yeah, and you claim that this was not possible.
And he says that he's quoting the Rambam, but in the same paragraph he quotes the Rambam as saying, no, it's silly and it's stupid, and nobody would think it's 6 hours, because it's 18 hours, which the Rambam really does say, both in Kiddush HaChodesh and I think in the Parasha Mishnah. So there is a Rashi that says 6 hours. In the Gemara, somebody in the Gemara, I forget where, is quoted as saying 6 hours. So I assume this is just a typo or a bilbul. The Rambam never says 6 hours.
Did you write to them?
I did, right. I haven't checked all of my inboxes to see if they're open, but I don't think so.
Well,
right?
You'll update us if you hear back.
Yeah, but yeah, it's pretty clear the Rambam says that the minimum is 18 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was last week. 2 weeks ago, I brought this to the show.
Thank you.
What are you talking about?
Everyone else? Let's just hop in Svi. It's the old 100 shekel note, and on the back is Pekin, which is up in the Galil, and here's the shul. Yitzhak Ben Tzvi was a choker Eretz Yisrael, and among his areas of study was the history of the Jews of the Galil. So here's that synagogue in Pekin, which claims to have stones built into it from, I think, Bayit Rishon, and that was the context in which we mentioned this. And then here's the carob tree that is planted there in the town square, zecher to the carob of Shimon Bar Yochai and his son who hid out in that cave. You want this back?
And I also recall, I sent it in the WhatsApp, but for those of you that weren't here, right, as Rabbi Gamliel said, that sometimes the moon moves faster, sometimes the moon moves slower, which is very true astronomically, and the Rambam gives you like clear calculations to know how long the actual Molad is going to be. But you can see here that over the course of, this is from 5765 Shvat to 5773, so over the course of 8 years, the actual length of the months vary by up to a difference of plus 15 hours or minus 12 hours.
Over what period?
This is over the course of 8 years. But the average is exactly 29 days, 12 hours, and 54 minutes is the average. But the true month could deviate by up to about 12 to 15 hours, plus or minus, from that.
Right. So there was this interesting thing this past Shabbat. We had the Birkas HaChodesh this past Shabbat.
Right.
And the Molad was
on the Shabbat.
That morning.
Well, the Molad was, depending on whether you went to the early minute or the late minute.
Yeah.
The Molad was at what time? Around 8 o'clock?
8 something in the morning.
Something.
Yeah.
We had a whole argument with the first minyan. And when he announced the Molad, he said, "Ba'molad haya." And everyone goes, "Yeah." No, Molad diyeh.
Right.
And then so he looks at what he looks at. It's like,
yeah. So the Molad was Saturday morning at
8:47.
Because he read it from the Torah Tidbits.
And when was the moon actually first visible?
Okay, so two things, since you asked. So when we announced the Molad...
It's not the real Molad.
We're announcing the average Molad, and it's also not clear in which time zone that is. Right? Because back when the Rambam was doing stuff, we didn't have standard time zones around the world.
Uh-huh.
So the usual assumption...
And it's not just time zone, it's...
Time, like when you say 847, 847 where? In Baghdad, in Alexandria, in Yerushalayim.
Which aspect?
So people usually assume that it's Jerusalem local time, which is off by 45 minutes in the summer and 27 minutes in the winter.
Why?
Because, you know, time zones are
relative,
wide across the globe in modern times. But in the old days, local noon was when the sun was over your head, not somebody else's head in the village next door. So, but it's not really clear that it's actually Jerusalem time. But that's... So anyways... This is the standard Kiddush HaChodesh time.
That's why in some of the Lukot there's like the Molad, and then there's the actual, it'll say the actual Molad.
So that's a different thing. So first of all, there's like the Molad, which we don't change for summer and winter time. We don't change for Jerusalem times. We don't really know where it is. And then there's the actual Molad, which is like according to this diagram. This month might have been shorter, or might have been faster or slower. So the actual astronomical Molad for people living in Israel is at the second time, which you might find in some Lukot. That could also be off by, well, it's basically off by this plus or minus half an hour based on daylight savings time.
All right. Anyway, back to the Gemara. So, Rabbi Yehoshua, Balo Etzel Rabbi Dosa, we're 5-6 lines from the bottom by the two dots. Balo Etzel Rabbi Dosa, Kaf Hei Omer Aleph. Bolo Etzel Rabbi Dosa ben Hyrcanus. So the Mishnah says that he went to that Rabbi Yehoshua, who's kind of stuck in this bad position on the eve of Yom Kippur. He goes to Rabbi Dosa ben Hyrcanus. Amarlo im boin anu ladun achar. This is what the Mishnah says. Ba ladun achar betin shel Rav Gamliel tzichan anu ladun achar kol betin uvetin. Says, look, in other words, you're going to ask Akasha about maybe Rav Gamliel got it wrong. He's trying to boost him up. And he's reminding him that even if there's a kind of astronomical error here, halachically, it still has integrity. Tanu Rabbanan, says our Gemara. Lama lo nitparshu shemotam shel zkenim halalu. In other words, when in the first betin, in the first Kiddush HaChodesh, which we hear about when?
This week's Parsha.
HaChodesh HaZelochem. Remember Rashi? The first Rashi tells you that the Torah really should just begin this week. We should have gone from Simchas Torah straight to here. And Rashi has explained why the Torah has all these other stories that appear before the halachic material starts. But it's interesting that Rashi, or the Midrash, which Rashi is telegraphing to us, the Midrashic assumption, I mean, it's like a Havamina. You know what a Havamina is? It's a good question, which happens not to, like, we know what the answer is. Like, I mean, we know why the Torah has Adam HaRishon and Noach and Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov and Yosef and his brothers and the birth of Moshe and all that other stuff. Because the Torah is not just a legal code. It's not just Hammurabi. Right? But there's like a Havamina, if the Torah is a work of halacha. So what's the halacha? Like, the halacha begins with HaChodesh HaZelochem. Because halacha is something that exists in a system of time, of holy time, of sacred time, of secular time. So it makes sense that HaChodesh HaZelochem should be the beginning. And we have to give an explanation why it's not. But it's a good question. So that first betin, which was Moshe and Aaron and the Shivim Zizkenim. So why don't, I mean, well, the Torah was cheating on, was cheap on ink. Give us the names. Tell us what's in there. Let us know those guys. Wouldn't it be nice if we knew who they were? I mean, think about all the Nisi'im, right? Like whenever you have the Nisi'im, you have all these Nisi'im with all those strange, you know, you don't meet too many kids walking around with the names of Nisi'im. Right? Susi, Vofsi.
Those were Nisi'im's parents.
Okay. So tell us, why does it mention names? Shelo Yemru Adam, Ploni Kamoshe, V'Aaron, Ploni Kenada V'Avihu, Ploni Ke'eldad U'Meidad. Because we wouldn't want people in subsequent generations going, is our rabbi like Moshe and Aaron? Is our rabbi like Nadav V'Avihu? In other words, we wouldn't want people to make these kinds of comparisons to the detriment of whoever the contemporary Batei Din are. V'omer, Vayomer Shmuel el Ha'am, Hashem Asher Asa et Moshe v'et Aaron. After in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yud Beis, after Shmuel kind of begrudgingly gives them the king that they ask for, and be careful what you ask for, towards the end of his, you know, his career is winding down, and he has this kind of speech. It's not yet his farewell speech, but it reads as if it could be. As a matter of fact, it actually reads very similar to George Washington's final speech. George Washington's farewell to the troops, I should say. Where he says, Shmuel says to them, I mean, look at me. I swear, you swear, testify. Have I gotten rich off? I've been the leader of the Jewish people. Have I gotten rich off of you? No, right? If you look at my pockets, will you find anything I took that you know? And as he's trying to point out that he's moving on in his career with his integrity intact, which is not something that every single leader can say. Perhaps you've seen the headlines. So he says. Vayomer Shmuel el Ha'am Hashem Asher Asa et Moshe v'et Aharon. It's like a strange word, Asa, that he made Moshe and Aaron. Right? But what he means is, there he's talking about Hashem who like appointed Moshe and Aaron, Hashem who made them into leaders to bring you out of Egypt. Vayomer, and the next pasuk, Vayishlach Hashem et Yeruvael v'et Badan v'et Yiftach v'et Shmuel. And then he lists other leaders, including himself. So who are these people? Who's Yeruvual? Ze Gidon. Valamen, how did you know that? Valamen nikra shmo Yeruval, shasa miriva im habal. It's like one of these names that's... Badan, ze Shimshon. Valamen nikra shmo Badan, da'ati mi Dan. Because he came from Shevet Dan. The Yiftach Kimashmo, and Yiftach, that was his name, that was his nickname. Va'omer Moshe Aaron Bikohanav Ushmuel Bikore Shimo. So on one hand you have Gidon and Shimshon and Yiftach. And on the other hand you have a Posuk which is Moshe Aaron and Shmuel. So Gidon and Shimshon and Yiftach, they weren't necessarily the best of the best, to say the least. Hakatuv shakal hakatuv shlosha kalei olam kishlosha chamurei olam. The Torah measured out or equated three lightweights against three heavyweights. Why are Gidon and Shmuel, Gidon and Shimshon and Yiftach lightweights?
They weren't the greatest of guys.
Yiftach sacrificed his daughter.
Yiftach, you know, sacrifices him. I mean, he murdered his daughter. We don't believe in human sacrifice.
Sorry.
In other words, he was just such a fool for making this promise.
I like the fairy tale ending, which
you did. Okay. Gidon, but even, you know what? Even if in the fairy, what do you call the fairy tale ending?
A guy. Still a guy.
Gidon manufactured an ephod, a kind of like poor man. No, ephod is the a poor man's urim v'tumim. In other words, he thought he could create a manner in which people could gain access to divine knowledge by shortcut, and this was criticized. Shimshon, even though, you know, he's known as like this great hero, well, you know, he probably shouldn't gotten involved with
Shiksa,
with Delilah, and Yiftach, as we said,
somewhat controversial.
Yes. Lomar chayiruval bedoro kemoshe bedoro, badan bedoro kaaron bedoro, Yiftach bedoro kishmuel bedoro. Lelamdecha shafilu kal shebekalin v'nitmana parnas al hatzibur harehu keabir shebarim. In other words, it's true that these three were not great, and the other three were really great, but it doesn't matter. Why? Because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter their personal attributes. I mean, it does, of course, matter their personal attributes. But in terms of their authority is the same. Right, you know, this is like the argument about. Well, I don't want to talk about. No, I was going to talk about Trump. No, in other words, whether you think Trump is really very good or is really very bad, or whether you think that Trump is like, it doesn't matter what he does because, you know, like everything he does for Israel. Although all those people might now be having second thoughts based upon what just happened an hour ago. Oh, they announced the
a
plan.
We're not going to get back to the Gemara if we start.
No, but everybody agrees that Trump is not a paragon of personal virtue. Can we all agree to that?
Even Reverend Hagee would agree.
But his authority is the same as FDR and Lincoln. It's the office, it's not the person who occupies it. So in that regard, Yiftach Bedoro Kishmuel Bedoro. The Yerushalmi, the Nusach and the Yerushalmi is different. And in some ways it's better. Because Yiftach Bedoro Kishmuel Bedoro, you have to then do what I just did. You have to add the caveat to say we're not talking about their personal attributes, their personal virtues, their authority, the authority that they possess. The Nusach in the Yerushalmi is Beit Dino Shel Yiftach ke Beit Dino Shel Shmuel. Right?
Clearly he's talking about the authority.
And there it's much more obvious.
Every generation gets the underrepresented
that it deserves. Va'omer uvata el hakohanim halevi'im ve'el hashofet asher yeh b'yamim ahem. In Parsha Shoftim, it says you'll go to the kohanim, to the levi'im, to the shofet, which is in that in those days, in that generation. V'chi tale al datcha she'adam holech etzel hadayan shelo haya b'yamav. What does it mean? It's redundant. Of course you're going to go to the judge who's in your generation. How are you going to go to the judge that lived two generations ago, three generations ago? Ha ein lecha lelech ela etzel shofet she'ibamav. No, that's it. You got to dance with the girl that shows up, right? In other words, he's your shofet, so he has the authority, right? You know, it's like a problem, like a. You know what the worst thing can ever happen to a rabbi? He can have a rabbi emeritus. Right? I remember when I was a kid, there was a shul, not the shul that I went to, but a shul nearby.
The one that you refused to go to.
Huh? No, it was in a different town, but you know, I'd be there from time to time. And that was this little shul where the rabbi, the previous rabbi, was an old European Rav. Like, he was one of the last European Rabbonim. And he was a real Talmud Chacham. But you know what happened? Talmidei Chachamim came to America in the 30s and 40s. They were a dime a dozen. Like, you know, what were they going to do? Like, how was the Talmidei Chachamim? So he went and became rabbi in this small little town. It was not dissimilar to the town that I grew up in, which I've told you about before, which was an Orthodox congregation with a largely non-Orthodox population. And he served that town with distinction until he retired at a ripe old age. And then a new, younger rabbi came in. And the old European Rov sat on the bima as the rabbi emeritus. And the new rabbi would get up and say a sermon or give a shiur. And the old rabbi would sit there, make it look like he was, you know, weaned on a pickle. Right? You know, like sour-faced. And, you know, that's, you don't want that. Right? And each generation has to find and see in its own leader the authority and power and the dignity of the rabbinate, of the Torah in him. We should do away with this idea of the rabbi emeritus.
One of the writers, it says I'm the vice president of OU emeritus.
Several emeritus.
Okay.
No.
Sometimes it used to be like when they'd list the board members, you get an asterisk by your name and it would say deceased. Like you were allowed to stay on the stationery for 3 years or whatever it was
after
you died.
Unless you asked for an extension.
Yeah, right.
Let's ask in person.
Yeah, we did that at Mendel. We left Morris the chairman for one term after he died.
Omer al tomar ma hayasha hayamim harishonim hayu tovim me'ele. And a person shouldn't say the old days were better than now. Right? In other words, nostalgia is nostalgia. But on the other hand, you have to live in the moment. And you have to, in other words, it is what it is. Right? The leaders that you have are...
Like the Rebbe says, you have to live with the times.
Tanu Rabbanan. Kevan shara oto omed mechiso v'nashko al rosho. So when Rabbi Gamliel Taka, when Rabbi Yoshua Taka goes on his Yom Kippur, so Rabbi Gamliel gets up, he kisses him on the head, and he says to him, Shalom lecha, shalom alecha, Rabbi v'talmidi. Rabbi shelemaratani Torah berabim. You are my master because you have taught Torah to the masses. You are, in some ways, Rabbi Yoshua may have been the greater chacham, but he didn't have the authority, or he didn't have the age, or he didn't have... But you are my disciple because I have made a decree and you have accepted it, you have followed it. Ketalmid, as if you were my student. Ashrei hador, and then the Gemara ends with this pion. Ashrei hador shagdolim nishma'in l'ketanim. Fortunate is the generation where the great ones, the elders, the leaders listen to their juniors. Ashrei hador shagdolim nishma'im l'ketanim, kal v'chomer ketanim l'gedolim. So if it's a good thing that the elders listen to the youngsters, so kal v'chomer that the youngsters should listen to the elders. So the Gemara says, kal v'chomer? What kind of kal v'chomer is that? Chiyuvahu. You don't need to learn out that the youngsters should listen to the elders, that the junior members should listen to the senior members. That is, it's a chiyuv. There's an obligation to listen to of kvod zkenim, of kavod haTorah. Right? No. So ella mitoch shehagdolim, and as it's not, he's not trying to teach you a halacha. He's trying to teach you a kind of the facts of the world. Ella mitoch shehagdolim nishma'im l'ketanim. If the elders will show the kind of modesty and show that they have what to learn from their juniors, nosim ktanim kal v'chomer ba'atzman, the youngsters will understand on their own that they should be listening to the elders. In other words, an older person or a more senior person, you know, seniority is not always a function of age, but they often come together. Experiences or inexperiences, a mum over. You gain it as you get older. Well, you don't always learn from it. But if the elders listen, hearken, take heed of the youngsters, so then the youngsters will certainly adopt that level of modesty and pay attention to the elders, who anyway they have an obligation to respect. Hadrin aloch im einan makirin. Yeah, fair. We finished. So now let's go to the fourth parak. We learned the first. Now you can drink your lachayim. Fill her up.
Just as we finish this parak, we should finish many pakim. As we finish this parak, we should finish many masechtot.
And steak. What? We learned parak shalosh. And it's, we've jumped around.
Chaim.
Because when we started with the shofar stuff, and then we went back to the Rosh Chodesh stuff.
Let me add just one last thing. I didn't answer the question before. When the molad was in the morning on Shabbat, so when was the new moon visible? So the new moon was not visible that evening.
On Saturday. And
on Saturday night, it was impossible.
So which is why Rosh Chodesh was only on Monday.
Yes and no. Right, because just like this is a different topic in itself, but as you probably know, that in the time of the Mishnah, as we're reading, Rosh Chodesh was when you saw the new moon. Yeah. But according to our calculated calendar, Rosh Chodesh is calculated by the moment of the average molad, and then we have the tachiyot, and then we have the tachiyot.
So, what would have been the average molad? Or what was the average molad? This
The average molad was
what we know.
Saturday morning
at 8,
right.
Whatever.
Right. So, but our calculated calendar is based on the average molad of Tishrei plus the Dechiyot.
Explain what the Dechiyot are.
Let's do the simplest one. Right? Let's say you calculate that the molad of Tishrei is going to be on Sunday. Mm-hmm. So then Rosh Chodesh should be on the Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Chodesh should be on the Sunday next year on the 31st day after Elul. Except that we have a dechia that lo adu rosh. Rosh Hashanah can never be.
Everything has to be adjusted
on a Sunday. So therefore, Rosh Hashanah becomes on a Monday, and that pushes off Rosh Chodesh for all the subsequent months also. So generally, the new moon visibility is often not on the first day of the month. But this year, or for the second half of this year, the new moon was actually visible Sunday night, which was also Rosh Chodesh, which is a nice coincidence, but often doesn't happen. And it was basically visible because...
But the fact that it was visible on Sunday night, you're saying, has nothing to do with the fact that Sunday night, Monday was...
We don't look for visibility anymore, right? I mean, our calendar is basically shifted backwards by 18 hours. Uh-huh. But because Mar Cheshvan had 30 days in it this year, so our calendar got pushed forward by about a day, whereas usually you don't see the crescent moon until like Bet or Gimel B'Chodesh. This month you could actually see it on the first. And here you can see some nice pictures that were taken by the Israel New Moon Society. I'll pass it around because it's hard to see. But the first pictures from a telephoto lens on Sunday night, just to like give you an idea of how small the moon is. And this is actually a relatively easy moon to see because it was already like 36 hours old.
That's Sunday night. And the moon would have been right around over
here. The moon would have been like this.
So you have to
like squint and look closely. The moon's like over there.
That's at sunset.
The way home Sunday night is very.
But that picture's taken more or less at sunset.
Right. So there's like a little moon there, and this is just a cool picture taken. Well, let's see. This is a nice picture, like with the moon over there, and there are these unidentified flying balloons going by. Nobody quite knows like what they were. I'm like looking at the picture, like what is that? This was taken in Jerusalem, so I don't think they came from Gaza. But
they made it to Beit Shemesh.
This is true. Anyway, so if you're interested, you can subscribe to the Israel New Moon Society and get pictures like this every month.
To the National Society for New Moons, that's impressive. Mm-hmm.
There are like people that are practicing, so in the time of the Sanhedrin, Ba'atid, they'll be practiced in finding the moon and being able to pass Rav Gamliel's test.
But can you be a witness with the WhatsApp? You just take a photograph and send it to the
person. Okay. Daf Kaftet Omud Beis, the fourth parak.
You can redeem your program with PayPal.
The Mishnah is, let's at least learn the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Yom Tov Shabbat. Now this is the fourth parak deals with, it's back to Tzkiyat Shofar. It starts with the topic of Shabbat, of not blowing Tzkiyat Shofar on Shabbat. Blowing Tzkiyat Shofar, that's... tautology. Not blowing shofar on Shabbat, and then other matters related to the actual practice and integration of Tkiyat Shofar into Tfilah. As you know, we blow the Shofar in two different ways. There's the Shofar that we blow before Musaf, that's called the Tkiyot Dimiyushav, the sitting down Tkiyot, which is of course a misnomer since we stand up for all the Tkiyot. As opposed to the Tkiyot Dimiumad, the standing Shofar, because it's part of the Amida. And even that, you know, there are different ways to do it. The mainstream custom amongst Ashkenazim is that the Tkiyot are blown during the Chazarat HaShatz, after each of the three special brachot that are added into the Musaf, the Malchiot, Zichronot, and Shofrot. And then, in addition to the Tkiyot that we blew beforehand, we add more Tkiyot at the end, after Kaddish, in the middle of Kaddish, whenever it is, in order to fulfill the custom of blowing 100 kolot.
Where does that custom come from, by the way?
That's a custom that's based upon this midrashic idea that Aim Sisra, you know, cried 100 times. But it's a custom that we have that we do this. You know that the Sfaradim and certain Ashkenazim blow shofar also in the silent Shmoneh Esrei. Chabad does it, yeah. Well, Chassidim do it. In the shul I grew up in, they did it this way also. So when you were davening the silent Shmoneh Esrei, when you got up to the end of Malchiot, you were supposed to wait until they blew shofar. And if you were a slow davener, they blew shofar before you got there, you would just pause and listen, like you do like for Kedusha. If you're in the middle of your Shmoneh Esrei still and they get up to Kedusha, you just pause and listen. It's easier for the Balei Tokeya, because you don't have to do as many in one shot. Because at the end, then you only need to do 10 instead of doing
40. 30 plus 10.
And at least according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, it's like the real way to do it.
Which way?
To blow in the silent Shmoneh Esrei. For reasons that we'll talk about when we get to that particular sugya.
Did you mean this specifically before you said the mainstream way, and then you quoted the Ashkenazi way, which is the minority? So.
No, I said the mainstream Ashkenazi practice is... Mainstream was an adjective amongst Ashkenazi. But why do you say the majority? Even after having lost 6 million almost exclusively Ashkenazi Jews in the Holocaust, Ashkenazim worldwide, Ashkenazim still outnumber Sfaradim.
Yeah, but... Okay, well then you have to define Ashkenazi, because people who daven Nusach Sfar...
Correct.
No, but they don't do it in the middle of the meeting. People daven...
Again, they're different cousins. Chabad does... Some do.
Yes, but most Ashkenazi, what? Like in our shul...
Nusach Sfar,
our shul, they daven Nusach Sfar almost every year.
I said there was once or twice we've done it during the Amida.
So, anyway, there's different customs, and...
When I grew up in my... Nusach Sfard, and that's the way they do it.
Anyway, again, even amongst those who daven Nusach Sfard,
Chassidish Nusach Sfard,
not everyone does it, and there's different customs. The Briskers apparently favored this position. We'll talk about that when we get there in the Gemara. The Mishnah here says, Yom Tov Shal Rosh Hashanah Shechaliot B'Shabbat. When Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbat, B'Mikdash Hayu Tokin, Aval Lo B'Medina. In the Mikdash, they would blow shofar even on Shabbat, but in the Medina, does not mean the state of Israel, it means outside the Mikdash, they would not blow. Now, how you define the border between Mikdash and Medina is a machlokus between the Rambam and Rashi. The Rambam holds, when we say B'Mikdash Hayu Tokin, he doesn't just mean inside the walls of the Beit HaMikdash, he means Yerushalayim. And it's in the times of the Mikdash on Rosh Hashanah. If you were not in the Mikdash itself, but you were in Yerushalayim, which meant you were in the old city, there was only the old city, so then you would blow up there near the Rova. Rashi disagrees, and Rashi says Mikdash is Mikdash, only within the confines of Beit HaMikdash itself.
No, those who hold that it's Yerushalayim Kula. we'd hold the same by lulav and etrog on Shabbat.
So we'll come to that later in the Gemara. But there was one year when we lived in Baca. It was Shabbos after Rosh Hashanah was Shabbos and Sunday. And Shabbos afternoon, I was sitting in the den, valiantly struggling to keep my eyes open. Because in those days, I used to be a real machmir. And you know, there's a minig not to sleep on Rosh Hashanah. So you shouldn't have a shlufi mazel. And I'm sitting there and I'm struggling to stay awake because God forbid I should fall asleep and violate this holy minig of not napping on Rosh Hashanah. Even today, I don't. Shabbos, like a long Shabbos afternoon, I get out of my clothing, I get into my pajamas, and I take a nap. But on Rosh Hashanah, even today, even though I know I'm going to fall asleep, I don't have so much chutzpah. I don't change out of my clothing. I say, if like sleep overtakes me, so what can I do? It's always
on the couch. You're not planning right. For it to happen.
So I'm sitting on the couch in the study in Baca. You know, Baca is, you know, within spitting distance of the old city. And people tell me, I hear Tkiyat Shofar. We hadn't blown Shofar that day because it was Shabbos. So the halachic mind goes to work. I start thinking, maybe. I mean, the guy, whoever was blowing Shofar, should have been blowing Shofar. I never had discovered who it was.
While you were sleeping, the Mashiach came.
Maybe. I mean, Taka, the guy should have been blowing Shofar. But should I have had, like, anyway, should I have had Kavana to be Yotzei? Because maybe we paskin. So, the Gemara, the Mishnah says, B'mikdash hayu token, avalo b'medina. Let's understand Mikdash means Mikdash. Beit HaMikdash. Mishacharav Beit HaMikdash, hitkin Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, shiyu tokin b'chol makom shiyesh bo betin. So after Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, Rabbi Yochanan made a takana that wherever there's a betin, there they can blow. So which betin? Any betin? Are we talking about
Yavne?
Are we talking about like the betin where the Sanhedrin had been removed to? So Amar Rabbi Elazar, lo itkin Rabban Yochanan. Now there's a debate, not against Rabbi Yochanan, but what did Rabbi Yochanan mean? Amar Rabbi Elazar, lo itkin Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, ela biyavne, bilvad. Now you know, after Churban Abayit, the Sanhedrin moved to Yavne. After that, it moved to other places. So he says, no, Rabbi Gamliel's, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's takana was that Yavne had an elevated status over all other places. And when the Sanhedrin was in Yavne, even though there was no Mikdash, nevertheless, they continued to blow shofar in the Betin in Yavne. Amrulo, when Rosh Hashanah came out on Shabbat. Amrulo, so they answered, they responded to Rabbi Elazar, Echad Yavne v'echad kol makom shiesh bo Betin. So they disagree with Rabbi Elazar, who limited Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's takana,
enactment.
He said, no, wherever there's a betin. Now, Lamaisa, you have to understand, well, what's a betin? You know, like, an Erev Rosh Hashanah, three guys get together and do a Taras Nadarim. Presumably, that's not the betin we're talking about. But even here in Efrat, in Gush Etzion, in Yerushalayim, Yir HaKodesh, there are Batei Din, but real Batei Din. Batei Din that if we volunteer ourselves to be under their authority, they can determine that you owe him money.
Are they
right?
Real Batei Din?
So that's the question. So does Betin mean Betin Musmachim, meaning the kind of Betin that could have done Kiddush HaKodesh? Right, let's get among the things.
They're never in session.
No, they're not in session. Batei Din are not in session for adjudicating cases. But, like we saw, Betin was open on Shabbat for the purposes of Kiddush HaChodesh. Right? In other words, they just don't adjudicate cases. But they're still Dayanim, and they're still Batei Din, and they still have certain authority. So on Rosh Hashanah, the Betin would assemble for the purposes of having the shofar blown in their presence. So presumably after Smicha, the uninterrupted chain going back to Moshe Rabbeinu is interrupted. When that is of course a matter of debate, but generally speaking we say it was like in the 4th century CE, after zero. Some think it was earlier, some think it was later. But after that, so then certainly it's over. Except there is one minority opinion. The Rif, Yitzchak Alfasi, important Rishon, was of the opinion that any significant Bet Din, maybe a Bet Din that had Rav Yitzchak Alfasi as the Rosh Bet Din, was sufficient for the purposes of what? You don't need to be a Musmach to be part of the unbroken chain going back to Moshe Rabbeinu to be a Bet Din. If you're not a Musmach, there's certain things you can't do. You can't judge capital cases. You can't be Mekadesh the Chodesh. There's a whole list of things at the beginning of Sanhedrin that the Batei Din are authorized to do if they have Smicha. But we still have Batei Din today, even though we're very far removed by a millennium and a half, at least, maybe more, from Smicha. We have Batei Din for Mamonos, we have Batei Din for Kol Minei Dvarim. Right. So the Rif said no. If you have a Choshev Bet Din, you can blow shofar on Shabbat. And apparently in the Bet Din of the Rif, they blew shofar on Shabbat. But it never became a widespread custom, and after the Rif was dead, his own Talmidim did not continue this practice. No, the Rif was in Fez. Va'od zot haita Yushalayim yetera al Yavne, and Yushalayim had another advantage over Yavne. Shekol ir shehu ro'e v'shomat v'krovav yochola lavo tokin. U'beYavne lo hayu tokin el bebetin bilvad. In Yerushalayim, when they blew on Shabbat, it wasn't just in the Mikdash. It was
where
in the outlying areas. I'm not certain that this completely overlaps with what does this halacha sound like?
Megillah.
Like Shushan Purim. Right? Now the Shushan Purim is for a walled city and any city that's Samuch V'nireh. But not only in the Mikdash itself, in other words, what I said earlier was just the Havamina, it's not true. In the Mikdash itself they would blow, and if there happened to be a village outside of the walls of the old city, and it was close, and you could get there, so they would also blow.
Like from here?
Presumably not.
There.
You can't. Well, first of all, it's not. The Gemara will have to define what is Ro'e. So it's true that if you stand at the top of Kerwin's building, you can look out on a very clear day and see the walls of the old city. But you know what? In the times of the Mikdash, there was no Kerwin building.
You don't need a building. You can see it from many streets in Ephrat.
You can see the Yir Atika from many streets? Okay.
The Kippat.
Vishomat. What's Shomat? You can't really hear anything from the old city. Somebody, what's the loudest noise that was possible to produce in the ancient world?
When they came to wake up everybody in the morning at the Beit HaMikdash, they said it was heard all the way to Yericho.
Yes, but that may not be a historical statement, but a kind of when the American Revolutionary War started, they said it was the shot heard around the world. V'krovav yachol. Okay, so anyway, you can debate it, but in Yavne, the permission to blow shofar on Shabbat was limited to the Bet Din itself. The Gemara says minahanimili. How do we know? What is the source for the fact that we don't blow shofar on Shabbat?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we looking before a pasuk? I thought this is a gzeret rabbanan.
Well, in other words, you are superimposing your knowledge on the right. Now, since you know the conclusion, you're reading it through the prism of the conclusion. But the Gemara never does that. You should always, you know, in the words of, I think, Franz Rosenzweig, in the context of reading the Chumash, is also true here. You should always read it as if it's fresh. Right? You shouldn't be prejudiced by the fact that you know the conclusion. You know, like the story about the old woman sitting up in the balcony as Yosef is going down to find his brothers, and she shouts out, "Yossel, don't go down there! Don't you remember what they did to you last year?"
You're not allowed to blow the shofar. Forget the conclusion. You're doing it because of violates halacha of Shabbos. Or might lead you to violate halacha of Shabbos.
No. Fellas, we just finished learning a whole perek of Gemara, kol hakavod to you. It's a feather in your cap. But at this point, you should learn a little bit how the Gemara cup works. What is, when the Gemara says min ha'ani mili, what's the source? Right?
It's a
I don't know. Maybe it's a puzzle, maybe it's not a puzzle. But it's a way of clarifying what the principles at play are. Right? The Mishnah is apodictic. Apodictic? It's case law. It tells you the din. It doesn't give you the reasons. Generally speaking, the previous Mishnah that we learned that had that whole story was Yotzei Dofen. The Mishnah tells you the law. What's the law? You don't blow shofar on Shabbat except in the following locations. So why don't we blow? So when the Gemara, when the Mishnah says minhani mili, of course Chazal knew why. But minhani mili is a way of saying, let me explain to you what the principle behind this is.
That there's a pasuk attached.
Well, where do we get this?
Where do we get this idea from? You don't blow shofar on Shabbat. Minhani mili. Omer Rabbi Levi Bar Lachma, Omer Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina, Katuv Echad Omer. Shabbaton zikaron tru'a. There's one verse that says that Rosh Hashanah is the remembrance of the shofar. V'katuv echad omer yom tru'a yelechem. And the other one says it's a blasting day. It's the day that you taka actually do blow the shofar. So that is a, which one is it? Is it a day that we talk about blowing the shofar, or is it a day that we actually do blow the shofar? Lo kasha. It's not a contradiction. Kan biyom tov shechal yot b'shabbat. On Shabbat we talk about the shofar, but don't actually blow it. Kan biyom tov shechal yot b'chol. But on a weekday, Rosh Hashanah, so you actually blow it. So Omar Rava, wait a second. Imidiraitahi b'migdash hechi takina. Wait a second. You think that's serious? These two psukim. You mean that pasuk zichron shua means it's usher to blow the shofar midday, right? It's usher to blow the shofar on Shabbat. So how can you do it in Beit Hamikdash? Va'od ha lav melachahi. But all cases, tkiyat shofar is not one of the lamites melachos. So why should it be as malafshach? Why should it be mutter to blow it in the mikdash if it's usher on Shabbos? Why should it be mutter to blow it in the shofar if it's usher on Shabbos? And why should it be usher to blow it anywhere else if it's not a malacha? The itzterech chra lemeute. Why would you need a pasuk to tell you you can't do it if it's not usher? The Tana de Bei Shmuel kol melechet avodah lo ta'asu. You can't do any malacha on Shabbos. Yatzta tekiyat shofar v'ridiyat hapat shehi chokhma. What can't you do on Shabbat? I mean, forget the fact that the rabbis extended and added and made fences and there's all types of things, you know, under the general principle that which the Torah allowed, the rabbis forbade. You know that principle? It's just a humorous aphorism. People sometimes say to me, yeah, look, is it mutter too? And before they tell me what the question is, I say probably not. I mean, you can always find a way, Zetel, under the general principle that whatever the Torah allows, the rabbis will be. It's a joke.
Fellas, it's a joke.
Chadash Asur Min HaTorah.
You know what?
Chadash Asur Min HaTorah.
You know what?
It wasn't a joke.
You know what? If we'd had steak, you'd all be in a more jocular mood.
Either that or another four roses.
Right. So, in other words...
Rabbi said, kick your wife Shabbos for Shabbos.
What is that?
The rabbi said you should buy your wife flowers for Shabbos.
Four roses.
So he brought her four roses.
It was a very good Shabbos.
Yeah. For you.
I wouldn't try that.
So as you can't do malacha on Shabbos, but blowing shofar is not a malacha. It's called a chokhmah. A chokhmah is like a skill. Right? Not everybody knows how to do it. Another thing you can't do is rediat hapat. Now, you know how they used to make bread?
We plash it to the wall on the inside
well,
of the
oven. Well, you've all been to enough, you know, midurot and lag ba'omer to know what the tabun is. You know, tabun is like this, well, it's like a wok. They turn upside down on top of the fire. It gets very hot. And you take the dough and you slap it up onto the side of the hot tabun, and the heat, right, cooks it, and you have pita. So the tanurim in the times of Chazal were kind of like hollow, circular, tubular structures that sat on top of the fire with like an opening. Right today, if you go into like a real pita bakery, you can still look. You can still see ovens. If you go, you know, to the Pat Bamelech and Rosh Tzurim, which is closing on Friday, they're closing the sniff in Rosh Tzurim. They're moving everything to Efrat. But he has an old brick oven, right? And it's the same idea, even though it's bigger and more sophisticated than the ovens that Chazal had. But you know the Tanur Shel Achnai, the famous Tanur Shel Achnai.
Oh, yes.
Why is it called Tanur Shel Achnai? We just had this. Who's learning Daf Yomi? Nobody's. You're learning that, feel me?
Yeah, but I have to remember it now.
It was from like 2 days ago.
I did it 4 days ago.
Oh, because you're 2 days ahead.
Yeah.
No, I told you, you're not 2 days ahead. You're 2,709 days behind.
2,709 behind.
And other Tanush Achnai, it was like this coiled. You made the took the bricks and you coiled them around. And the question there is like, if the bricks are assembled in a certain way with. In like layers, is it a, can it become tummy or can it become tummy? But it's, but you have, in other words, you have like a, it looks like this, right? It's bigger, of course, and it's not, and there's like an opening, and you take the dough and you smack it
on the inside
it sticks to the wall, and then before it burns, you take this, whatever it is, this spatula or these tongs, and you pull it out. That activity of pulling out the bread is called ridia tapat. What ridia, like ridia from like lerit, like yurida, to horid, to take down, to remove. So Chazal said, are you allowed to take raw dough and put it into the oven on Shabbos? Why not?
Because
it's baking. It's bishul. But what if somebody put it in there before Shabbat? Can you take it out on Shabbat? Which you might want, because after all, fresh bread, fresh out of the oven, is better than older bread.
Day old.
So day old, or even hour old, or 2 hours old.
In any event.
So Chazal said, since we're worried that people will come to bake on Shabbat, or will put their bread in very, 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 very at the last minute, and it will become baked on Shabbat, so we make a gzeira. Not only can't you put the bread in, you can't take it out either.
Like which, taking clothes off the clothesline.
Exactly. So these two things, Ridiyat HaPat, it wasn't a malacha, it was a chokhmah, meaning not everybody knows how to do it, right? Just like not everybody knows how to make a nice bread, right? It's a chokhmah, as my wife will tell you, right? So these they're not even malachot. So what are we talking about? Ela Omar Rava Midiraita Mishra Shari. Rabbanan hu digazre bo kiderava. The Omar Rabba hakol chayvin betkiat shofar. The ena kol bekiin betkiat shofar. Gzeira shema yitlenu biyado v'yelechetz al haboki l'mad v'yavrenu arba amod b'rishut harabim. V'haynu tama delula v'haynu tama de megillah. So in other words, it's the Rabbanan, since not everybody knows how to blow the shofar, we're afraid that you will come to carry a shofar in the Rishut HaRabim, and that's the reason we don't blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and that's also the reason for Megillah, and that's also the reason for Lulav, but we'll come back to that next week.